Hi, this is Jury Duty. I'm your host, Chris Terracone. We have several programming notes for our podcast. First, we are going to pause our coverage of the trial of Alex Murdoch for the next 7 weeks. Second, this week, beginning with today's episode, in recognition of the death of O.J. Simpson last Wednesday, April 10th, we are reaching into the archives of Crime Story Media to present a series of special interviews related to the way that the historical narrative of Simpson's trial for the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman has been preserved for posterity. We begin today with Cary Antholis' exclusive interview with Bill Hodgman, who had oversight responsibilities for the team prosecuting O.J. Simpson, Marcia Clark, and Christopher Darden. That interview was conducted on January 24th, 2020, the 25th anniversary of the beginning of oral arguments in the trial. On Tuesday and Wednesday, we present Cary's two-part interview with Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander, the creators of the Emmy and Golden Globe-winning limited series, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. And on Thursday and Friday, we present Cary's two-part interview with Ezra Edelman, the producer and director of the Oscar and Emmy-winning documentary epic, O.J., Made in America. And finally, as you know, this Jury Duty podcast began by covering the L.A. trial of Robert Durst for the murder of his friend Susan Berman. Over the course of 3 years, we have published more than 150 episodes covering the trial, both before and after the pandemic, including extensive interviews with the lead prosecutor on the case, two of the trial's jurors, and Charlie Bagley, a reporter who had covered the Durst family for decades. As you may know, The Jinx 2, a six-part documentary series sequel to The Jinx about the LA trial of Robert Durst, premieres on the Max streaming service on April 21st. In parallel with that broadcast, we are scheduling a special event for Season 10 of the Jury Duty podcast. For each of the 6 weeks of the Jinx 2 series, we will re-release four of our favorite episodes about the Durst trial from the Jury Duty feed, for a total of 24 episodes. The first episode of Jury Duty, The Durst Trial's Greatest Hits, will drop on April 22nd. Now, on to the first episode of our Jury Duty special, The Legacy of the O.J. Trial. Here's Cary Antholis' January 24th, 2020 interview with former L.A. Assistant District Attorney Bill Hodgman.
Bill Hodgman served in the Los Angeles District Attorney's office for over 40 years until his retirement in 2019. The last of those 8 years, Bill served as the Assistant District Attorney overseeing the office's line operations. In 1994 and 1995, he was one of the lead prosecutors in the double murder prosecution of O.J. Simpson. I spoke with Bill by phone last Saturday, the day of the 25th anniversary of the commencement of oral arguments in the Simpson trial. My aim in talking to Bill was to explore the many facets of storytelling in that trial and to get the perspective from inside the prosecution's foxhole during those proceedings. I also sought Bill's perspective on the legacy of that trial, as it has been memorialized in popular culture. My apologies in advance for the static in our connection, but I think you will find that the thoughtfulness and honesty of Bill's commentary overcomes any technical imperfection in our presentation. And so, without further ado, here is my conversation with Bill Hodgman. We are joined on our Jury Duty podcast by Bill Hodgman, recently retired assistant district attorney. Today is to the day, I believe, the 25th anniversary of the beginning of oral arguments in the O.J. Simpson trial. And I'm really grateful to Bill for being with us today. Bill, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Cary. I'm pleased to be here.
Bill, would you just take us through what your responsibilities were in the district attorney's office at the time that O.J. Simpson was tried for the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman?
Certainly, Cary. At the time, I was the director of central operations for the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office. As such, I had oversight over several trial divisions and a number of special prosecution units. One of those special prosecution units was our special trials unit. At the time, that was the unit which handled many of the high-profile cases that were being prosecuted in Los Angeles County. It was a unit in which I had worked shortly before I was appointed director by then-District Attorney Gil Garcetti. And, you know, circa June 1994, in a sense, I had oversight over the special trials unit and the handling of high-profile cases because of my position.
And take us through your experience of the media coverage of the Simpson trial, beginning with your first sense of how different this was going to be than an ordinary major crimes case.
Yes. Prior to being involved with the Simpson case, I had tried some high-profile cases in Los Angeles County. Several years before, I had tried the Charles Keating case on charges of securities fraud. And that was a very high-profile case in L.A. County at the time. I felt that it was pushing the edge of the envelope in terms of a high-profile case and media reaction to the case. In hindsight, I would have to say that the Keating prosecution and the media treatment of it was a walk in the park compared to what occurred in the Simpson case. Almost immediately, it seemed like things were just off the charts, that is, off our experiential charts in terms of anything that we had seen or experienced. The media interest, the heightened media interest, the saturation of the media, the degree to which media intrusion impacted early investigation in the case, the treatment of the participants in the case. It seemed like as soon as any new player in the case was introduced, there was an immediate microscopic examination of that person's past and history and experience. So again, it was off the charts on a lesser scale, particularly for Marcia Clark and myself. Early on, we realized we were prisoners in the criminal courts building in downtown L.A. We could not leave the building to walk and get a sandwich without drawing a thundering herd of media representatives. So it was a wild experience, Gary.
And how did that impact decisions that were made about who would try the case and how the case would be tried?
That media component early on really did not figure in the decision-making about who would try the case or how the case would be tried. It was recognized that it was a dynamic that had to be dealt with, that we would have to take special efforts to ensure the integrity of our evidence and our work product. We were aware that almost immediately a black market of tabloid journalism was established and that there was a hunger, a desire for inside information about what was going on, not only in the prosecution camp, but in the defense camp. And as evidenced by what was revealed immediately before the preliminary hearing that Marcia and I conducted, is that witnesses had begun selling their story to the tabloids. And again, that was a dynamic which heretofore we really had not experienced before, but we quickly learned with all of our potential witnesses to ask the question, have you sold your story, what you have told us, to anyone in the media, tabloid or otherwise?
And now back to my conversation with Bill Hodgman. As you approach the beginning of the trial, how was the narrative crafted for the people's case against O.J. Simpson? Who was in charge of crafting that narrative?
Well, Marcia Clark was the designated lead prosecutor at the outset. I was asked by the district attorney after our grand jury proceedings were scuttled due to media contamination to assist Marcia with the preliminary hearing. So in effect, I became co-lead counsel rather than just an oversight manager on the case very early on. Marcia and I conducted the preliminary hearing. And Carrie, if I might, I mentioned that very early on in the proceedings that we had to recuse a grand jury proceeding as we were attempting to obtain an indictment of Simpson utilizing the grand jury process. But because of grand jurors not obeying the admonition by the overseeing judge about not paying attention to the media, not discussing anything that might be extraneous to the evidence that was being presented before the grand jury, it was discovered that our jurors were doing just that, that there was a particular tape which had been, which went viral, if you will, where Simpson was breaking into Nicole Brown's former residence in Brentwood, and she was calling the police, and in essence, it's known as the 911 tape. And that was not introduced in evidence, but something that had been released to the public, and our grand jurors, or members of the grand jury that was impaneled, were discussing it, and it was overheard, and that led to the rather extraordinary event of the grand jury being recused. Never before in my experience have I heard of such a thing nor had experienced it. So it was an example of how we were heading into territory that was really off the charts as far as our experience went.
So what is the process once a grand jury is recused for obtaining an indictment on Simpson in this case?
It procedurally at the time, we had filed the case by way of a criminal complaint, and we were attempting to supersede that complaint with obtaining the grand jury indictment. There were several reasons for this. One, we wanted to lock down witness testimony at an early stage before such testimony may be contaminated, but from whatever source. Secondly, there was a concern that Simpson's attorney of record at the time, Bob Shapiro, would continue the prelims ad infinitum. And we did not want to have justice delayed, so there was an effort to obtain a grand jury indictment, which would supersede the criminal complaint. When the grand jury was recused, the charging papers, that is the criminal complaint, was still extant, and we had a preliminary hearing, which was to occur within a matter of several days. That's when I was airdropped into the case.
Got it. And how did responsibilities evolve between the time of the various hearings in the case and the beginning of oral arguments? You continued in your oversight capacity, but did you step back from your participation as co-counsel with Marcia Clark?
No, for the first 6 or 7 months up into the opening statement, I was an active participant in the actual litigation of the case. I handled pretrial motions along with Marcia Clark. Marcia Clark and I selected the jury, which took about 11 weeks. So that was a very intense jury selection process. And so I was involved on a more boots on the ground level from the time of the preliminary hearing up until the time of the opening statements.
And then what happened?
Well, during the opening statements, I had a health condition develop. The discovery of a congenital muscular condition in my heart, which needed to be treated, as awkward as it was under the circumstances. And that necessitated a diminishing of my role as an in-court trial lawyer to back to my original position of really having oversight and more overall case management for the remainder of the case.
And as the case unfolded, and as you observed the media scrutiny and the media narrative that was playing out, how did that affect your input into the planning and the narrative that the prosecution put forward?
As I stated earlier, we were very concerned about preserving the integrity of our evidence, avoiding leaks, or anything that, you know, might jeopardize successful prosecution of the case. So careful measures were employed. If, for instance, we were going outside of our offices to a location well apart from the criminal courts building, we would have basically counter surveillance. We would have surveillance cars behind us to ensure we weren't being followed by the media or anybody else. And Terry, it sounds very much like spy versus spy, but that was the reality of the situation. Our lead detectives on the case were followed. For the principals on the prosecution side, we had very little freedom to do much other than drive to work early in the morning, leave work early at night, and try to get some sleep in between. So the omnipresence of the media was felt throughout. And we did have a director of communications who kind of ran block in terms of media requests and the like. But it was quite evident that the media coverage was very close, very saturated, and omnipresent, certainly, throughout everything we did.
As you observed the case that the defense was putting forward, what were your conversations like with the rest of the defense team about strategy vis-a-vis the jury? And about offering counter-narratives to address or counteract avenues that the defense was going down in their narrative strategy vis-a-vis the jury?
Well, first of all, we were aware at the outset that some months prior to the murders even occurring, that Bob Shapiro had authored an article in a journal for defense attorneys entitled something to the effect of how to use the media to your advantage in a high profile case. And we obtained a copy of the article, and realized this was going to be a blueprint for what Bob and later, John Cochran would be utilizing in terms of, using the media to their tactical advantage in the presentation of the case. And in terms of attorney commentary in the morning when they came into the courthouse, interviews which were held at their offices. So we were very cognizant that the defense was going to be utilizing the media as a sword, as part of their overall defense strategy. Now, we as prosecutors have to be more circumspect with regard to attorney commentary, particularly when a case is still pending before the court. Our ethical rules are such that we are not likely to go out and speak to the press. Our mantra is basically what we have to say, we will say in court. There were some exceptions in the course of the Simpson case, while the case was being prosecuted. But for the most part, we as ethical prosecutors had to be circumspect in our commentary, while the defense had more free rein to say whatever they wanted to say to try to influence people.
As the trial proceeded, What was your gut instinct on how the jury was receiving the narratives in the case?
The jury was very hard for me to read. They appeared to be very stoic and stone-faced. I really was unsure about how our narrative was landing. Now, we did get occasional glimpses into what some of the jurors' thoughts might be, and I'm thinking in particular, after we had concluded the opening segment of our case in chief, which dealt primarily with domestic violence and Simpson's history of domestic violence in physically and psychologically abusing Nicole Brown. And part of our strategy was to try to knock Simpson off the iconic pedestal upon which he resided. You know, as a star athlete, as a pitch man for various products, as a sort of a mediocre actor. But he was very charismatic, and he had a tremendous popular appeal. And we wanted to demonstrate that Simpson was not what he appeared to be as far as the general public was concerned. Well, in approximately March of 1995, three jurors were excused from the panel for various forms of misconduct. And they held interviews, and the primary statement that they were making was, "We don't understand why the DA's office put on all that evidence about domestic violence. Domestic violence had very little, if anything, to do with this case. We don't get it." That shook us to our very core, because we realized the domestic violence evidence had not landed and was not received as we had hoped and intended, and that at least this little subset of jurors felt it was really irrelevant. So we did get some feedback along the way about how our case was going. But ultimately, we had our game plan. We stuck to our game plan. And it took a long time to implement the game plan. But we did what we did to meet the standard of proof to which we were held, and to prove the elements of the case.
What was your reaction when the verdict came in?
I was standing in the courtroom when the verdicts came in, and I have to say I was stunned. And it's not that the verdicts were unanticipated, but to actually hear the words being spoken by the court clerk were stunning. And I, for what had to be microseconds, I felt sort of an out-of-body experience where I was trying to process, did I actually hear that? And it ultimately was hearing Kim Goldman sobbing behind me to my right. It was just this anguished, heartbreaking sobbing that I realized that the jury had walked Simpson, and it really struck home.
In the aftermath of the verdict, as you looked back on the narrative you presented, the narrative the defense presented, how did you interpret the way that the jury got to those verdicts? Did you poll the jury afterwards? Were you able to ask them questions? And if so, what were their responses?
We did not have an opportunity to question the jurors or to speak to them afterwards. My impression was they wanted to get the hell out of there as soon as possible, and that was that. So we never spoke to them afterwards.
And so after the fact, as you processed it, as you debriefed with fellow counsel, how did you process the way that the jury themselves processed the narratives from both the prosecution and the defense?
Well, a two-part response, Terry. Part one, the very afternoon following the verdicts being received by the court, some deputy sheriffs came to my office and asked to speak with me. And these were deputies who had ferried the jury from the hotel where they were sequestered to a sheriff's substation or facility where they rejoined their families and friends. And the message that the two deputies had for me was, Bill, you guys never had a chance. All we heard as on the bus, as the jurors were being transported, all they saw in the parking lot as the jurors rejoined loved ones and the like, they said over and over, we kept hearing, we did it, that was payback for Rodney King, that was payback for Rodney King. And that phenomenon has been reported back to me over the years and validated by a number of sources. Now, on a secondary level, a jury selection expert who was not employed during the case or by either the defense or the prosecution, but someone who had asked to speak to me, he put it like this. He said, you know, you guys were doing what prosecutors do. You present the evidence, you meet the elements of the case, and you encourage the jury to find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. In a sense, you guys were presenting the case on an FM frequency. He said the defense in the alternative was presenting on an AM frequency, that they were, frankly, kind of a disjointed defense of conspiracy contamination. And if you look at things logically, a lot of it really didn't stand up upon close examination. However, the themes were there that the jurors were receptive to, such as if the glove don't fit, you must acquit. If you remember the evidence in the case, if following Chris Darden's effort to put the gloves on Simpson's hands during trial, is subsequently sports photographers went to their archives and sent to us a dozen and a half photographs of Simpson wearing those very unique gloves. But that was more, I guess you might say, cut and dry evidentiary, whereas the theme expressed by Cochran had a more dramatic effect, which was, if the gloves don't fit, you must acquit. So those are my responses to how I believe the jury processed or was processing the evidence that was presented.
After the trial, as you were made aware of the way that the trial was being memorialized in popular culture, what was your sense of how kind of contemporaneous history was getting it right, getting it wrong? The people like Jeffrey Toobin, who wrote books about it, people like Dominic Dunn, who covered the trial, what was your sense of what they were getting right and what they were getting wrong?
Kind of a mixed response. Carrie, I was introduced to Jeff Toobin during the course of the trial. I did speak with him several times after the trial, and my sense of Jeff was that he had a pretty objective and accurate perspective on the case. I did skim read his book and found it to be a pretty good account of the case. I did not read any of the other books, the many books that were published about the case. At times I would be directed to a certain passage in a certain book by someone who was reading the book and asked about, you know, did this happen or did you know this happened? Dominic Gunn, I was introduced to him in the audience in the courtroom on one occasion. I didn't speak to him thereafter, and I really don't know what he wrote. While the trial was ongoing, we really didn't have time to focus on what was being written or talked about in the media. There was simply too much work to be done, and that had to be the priority.
As I mentioned to you, I'm going to be playing interviews that I conducted as part of a class that I taught at USC about crime drama, crime documentaries, and crime podcasts, and interviews that I conducted with Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander on the one hand. They are the creators, writers, and executive producers of The People vs. O.J. Simpson, the scripted FX miniseries that starred Cuba Gooding Jr., John Travolta, and many others. And I'm also going to be presenting an interview that I did with Ezra Edelman, the producer-director of O.J. Made in America, the ESPN documentary opus 10-hour film about the case. I know you participated in O.J. Made in America, Ezra Edelman's film. I'd love for you to tell me whether you watched either or both of those projects and also what your response to them was if you did.
Certainly, Gary. I did speak with Ezra Edelman. He contacted our office and asked to speak with me. Initially, I did not have a desire to participate in his project. Ezra was persistent and came back later and made another request to meet, and I did agree to meet with him, and I have to say I was impressed by how knowledgeable he was about even minute details about the case. He certainly had done his research and homework, and I was persuaded ultimately that his vision of his project was very comprehensive and balanced. I was impressed by the fact that he understood the social context of the times, the social context in which we tried the Simpson case. And I felt that was an important part of the overall narrative. And I felt ultimately Ezra, given the latitude he was given by ESPN, was going to produce what could very well be a definitive statement about the case. And so ultimately I wanted him to get it right. And I spent some time with him, giving him some insights into the case that I had not done in a public manner, where I knew the public at large would be receiving it. And so ultimately, I felt Ezra did a very good job. I thought he did get it right. I was impressed with the documentary. I did watch it. And I go so far to say as I think his documentary is essential viewing for anyone living in Los Angeles or Los Angeles County, because it was an important part of our history, of our contemporary history. With regard to the FX series, I watched very little of it. I watched perhaps 40 or 45 minutes of the opening episode. I had my concerns about the FX series going in. I could anticipate that this was a dramatic series. So I realized certain events were going to be dramatized, that the dialogue would be by necessity fictionalized, and perhaps the whole project commercialized to some degree. I was concerned that entertainment would be a primary driver or focus for the FX series. And I was very concerned that Ron and Nicole as victims and the brutality of how they lost their lives would be lost in the dramatic series. And I think overall I had a concern that rather than the documentary, that this dramatic series would become the benchmark for what people thought they knew about what happened in the Simpson case. So, in the end, I really can't address the FX series. The little bit I saw was difficult for me to watch, perhaps because I lived the case, and to see events that I knew about kind of dramatized or fictionalized just unsettled me. I know at one point, I think I may have been called into the room as my wife watched the series, and there was some scene where Bob Kardashian was meeting with his daughters and having some discussion, and my thought was, well, this is just an attempt by the production to capitalize on the post-trial notoriety of the Kardashian family. And so again, what interest I may have even had was gone by that point.
I gather that you give presentations on the OJ case and the OJ trial. Is that accurate?
Yes. A way for me to process what happened. And as you know, Carrie, I remained with the DA's office. I went on to become involved in other cases, other investigations of some profile. But in terms of trying to process what I thought was justice being derailed in the Simpson case, is I tried to study the case and distill from it lessons that could be of value to other prosecutors, to homicide detectives, to law enforcement executives, to a slight degree judges, to a larger degree even forensic scientists. So over the years, I have done presentations about lessons learned from the Simpson case for various audiences.
And does that presentation include any reflection on the media, the narrative presentation? I think I've heard you say that it was like the perfect storm of forces. And so it's difficult, I imagine, to take larger lessons from that. That said, were there any lessons that you include in your presentation about the role of the media, the role of social forces at play in divining what is going to impact a jury and what's not going to impact a jury?
Well, I would say the larger segment of the audiences I've addressed in this matter have been law enforcement, homicide detectives, and their upper management staffs, police chiefs, and subordinate command staff. So it's been kind of nuts and bolts about maintaining and ensuring the integrity of your evidence. And I cite a number of examples from the Simpson case, where a disgruntled employee, for instance, leaked certain information to the media. In particular, I speak about the dangers of the tabloid media, how the tabloid media will pay to play, so to speak, and pay witnesses for information. And again, I have examples from the Simpson case and actually some other high-profile cases I've handled where it illustrates the degree to which particularly the tabloid media will go to ferret out information for them to publish. So, I'm cautioning law enforcement about this dynamic and giving them certain ideas about how they can protect the integrity of their information in order to help protect the integrity of investigation and prosecution.
One of the more memorable aspects of the documentary itself, I remember Marcia Clark talking about the moment when the prosecution became aware of the Furman tapes. Is there anything related to Mark Furman and his background, his story, that has impacted your narrative about the trial, your conversations with law enforcement about how to go about their jobs?
Well, as a general observation, I would have to say in the Simpson case, there were more unanticipated, extraordinary events which occurred during the trial. I have a maxim with regard to high profile cases that the higher the profile the case, the stranger the events that surround it. And we had numerous examples of that in the Simpson case, from the Fiato brothers at the end of the case, and certainly the disclosure of the Laura Hart McKinney tapes. With regard to Mark Furman, we did our lawyer-like work. Instigator of looking into Mark came shortly after the preliminary hearing when the New Yorker magazine ran an article about Furman and his attempts to get a stress disability from LAPD. Heretofore, we did not know about Furman's efforts to do that. So we, in a lawyer-like fashion, have explored that and were prepared to treat that episode in Furman's career in trial. And again, we felt, Furman was a strong witness in certain respects, but he had that part of his background that needed to be treated, and in lawyer-like fashion, we were prepared to do that. What I don't think anybody could foresee was the existence of the Laura Hart McKinney tapes. And again, that was a drop from the sky, critical points that, we had to deal with on the fly. So,
right.
It fits my maxim about high profile cases and high profile case litigation. It's the higher the profile, the more extraordinary the events that surround it.
One last question, Bill, and I really appreciate your time here. My impression is that the combination of the Rodney King incident and trial of the police officers and the Simpson case had a massive impact on the culture of Los Angeles, and particularly the way that law enforcement relates to the African-American community. And when I say law enforcement, I of course mean the police department, but I also mean the district attorney's office. What would you say the legacy of the Simpson trial is for the relations between law enforcement and the African-American community in Los Angeles?
Kerry, that's a difficult one to answer. That relationship exists along what I characterize as a continuum, because well before the O.J. Simpson case, but after the Rodney King verdicts, and to a smaller or lesser degree, even before the Rodney King verdicts, and by that I mean the Simi Valley trial of the four LAPD officers, there was, particularly in downtown Los Angeles, in the Central Judicial District, where the criminal courts building is located, we had been experiencing the distrust in the community, particularly the African-American community, with regard to LAPD. And we were seeing cops-only cases, and by that I mean cases where your only witnesses were police officers. You didn't have civilian witnesses. It would be a dope case, a gun throw case, something like that. And we were experiencing in the Central District in downtown LA, jury nullification. We were getting statements from the community that we're just not going to trust the word of cops alone. So that the phenomenon was all of jury nullification was already occurring on the lesser cops only as witnesses cases, not so much on homicides and serious violent crimes. I certainly hoped that, you know, following the Simpson case, things would get better. As you well know, there was a divide societally between how Black America viewed the verdicts and how non-Black America viewed the verdicts. I've worked with police chiefs from Chief Bratton to Charlie Beck. I know Michael Moore, and I know how progressive they've been in trying to make things better. And I like to view things optimistically, that things are getting better. And yet we have a phenomenon which is as current as today's newspapers about LAPD Metro officers wrongly categorizing individuals they encounter as gang members on field identification or FI cards, apparently. And this is the latest kind of distressing chapter in that relationship between LAPD in particular and the community. Chief Moore is stepping up and is doing and saying the right things to hopefully address this issue. But much like with Rampart, much like with this present phenomenon, it seems things still pop up, which is disruptive towards a more harmonious relationship between the Black community and LAPD.
Bill Hodgman, I so deeply appreciate your time. Thank you, and best wishes to you on your life in retirement.
Thank you very much, Kerry. It was a pleasure to speak with you, and I hope we meet somewhere on down the line.
I look forward to that. Thanks again.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
That concludes my conversation with Bill Hodgman.
With that, we bring to a close this episode of Jury Duty, The Legacy of the OJ Trial. Please join us on our next installment as we present part one of Kerry's interview with Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander, the creators of the Emmy and Golden Globe winning limited series, The People vs. OJ Simpson. And if you would like to listen to these episodes early and ad-free, head over to our Jury Duty Crime Story Patreon page. You can find more information about this trial on our Jury Duty Crime Story Patreon page or at crimestory.com. Jury Duty is created and produced by Carrie Antholis. It was co-produced and edited by yours truly, Chris Terracone. Music for this episode was provided by Strike Audio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will come back for the next episode of Jury Duty.